Good to see so many of you again. Good to see that even Professor Weller has dropped his tie. So things can be up. Professor McLachlan, of course, contrarian here. Just a small household matter. I'll be chairing this session, but then I'll be Professor McLachlan kindly promises to do the heavy lifting here today. It's far more labor intensive than anything else. Then, welcome back, Dapo. It's of course a cliche to say this man needs no introduction, but today he definitely does not need an introduction. Had that 2 days ago. So Dapo, floor is yours.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Welcome to this series of lectures on the question of international immunity and ties. Absence of a tie from me today. I did again agonize over whether to wear one or not wear one. And you will be surprised to learn that I decided that I would, in fact, wear one. And then I got on the train and I realized that I left the tie at home. So I have left Professor McLachlan with the task of carrying the banner, and he's got the tie on today. People who had ties on day one and day two, they perceived that I wouldn't be wearing a tie today, and so some of them have dropped it. I want to commend your resilience in coming back for a third day, though I'm not deceived that you're just coming back for the delights of the lecture. I have, in fact, sampled some of the delights of the sandwiches and the other thing, and I'm sure that some of you are here for that, but you've decided to still persevere and come in for the lecture after having the lunch. But it's sort of nice to have today to round off. So in the first lecture, what I did was I provided an overview of the immunities that international law confers on state officials from the exercise of the criminal jurisdiction of other states. And we looked at the reasons for those immunities. Yesterday, I examined the question of whether there is an exception to immunity when a state official is sought to be prosecuted for international crimes in the domestic courts of foreign states. And in that regard, I talked a bit about the work of the International Law Commission on the topic, how the ILC has come to provide for an exception with regard to immunity ratione materiae in the case where states seek to exercise, where they seek to prosecute a state official for international crimes. And we talked about whether or not the position adopted by the ILC reflects existing law or is, in some sense, progressive development. My own view being that such an exception to immunity ratione materiae does exist in customary international law on the basis of practice after World War II, and that in addition, with respect to some of the crimes concerned, that a number of treaties which establish those crimes and provide for extraterritorial jurisdiction over those crimes, in my view, have the effect of removing immunity ratione materiae. And though, as I set out yesterday, I disagree with some of the reasons that have been put forward in the literature for this exception, I still think that this exception is consistent with the underlying principles regarding immunity ratione materiae. And I explored at the very end the question of whether immunity ratione is really absolute, as is commonly said to be the case, which suggested that as between belligerent states, it's permissible to derogate, at least from some aspects of this immunity, and certainly with regard to targeting and retention, though these acts would ordinarily be inconsistent with the inviolability that is associated with immunity ratione personae. I also stated that belligerents may subject the leaders of other belligerents to prosecution. And during the Second World War, it was considered that such prosecutions could extend after the war. And in my view, and the final point made, that though that exception exists as between belligerents, they only benefit, or it only benefits the victim, as the aggressor cannot, as a result of its aggression, derogate from rules that would otherwise bind it. So that's where we got to. Now, today I'm going to address the question of whether international law immunities apply in circumstances where a state official is sought for prosecution by an international tribunal. Now, if we start from the proposition that I've just talked about, or which I talked about yesterday, start from the proposition that there is no immunity ratione materiae with respect to prosecutions for international crimes in the domestic court, then it would seem to follow that no such immunity, i.e. immunity ratione materiae, applies in cases where states establish international tribunals to prosecute international crimes. So if we start from that proposition, then in practice, the question, in fact in law, the question with regard to international tribunals relates actually solely to immunity ratione personae and relates solely in relation to the serving head of state, head of government, and foreign minister. And if you think, for example, about the ICC, the question that we're looking at would not be relevant, for example, to the prosecution of Rodrigo Duterte, the former president of the Philippines, who's currently being prosecuted by the ICC, the International Criminal Court, because he's no longer the head of state. And so the only possible immunity would be ratione materiae, and that would be excluded. Now, it's precisely this question of whether the Troika can be prosecuted that proved to be problematic in the negotiations of the special for the creation of the special tribunal for the crime of aggression against Ukraine. Now, those negotiations were created or were conducted, sorry, by what was called a core group. So a group of states, about 40 of them, broadly supportive of the establishment of the tribunal. Now, within that core group, there was a group, sometimes referred to as the core group, that was of the view that the statute of the tribunal should exclude immunity ratione personae, or at least the statute should be silent on that question and thus open the door to prosecuting the Troika. However, there were a number of other states within the core group, notably the G7 states, who were adamant that the statute should specifically provide that the Troika could not be prosecuted. And different arguments were made on either side for these positions, and we'll return to these arguments. Now, in the end, the statute has a provision which is now standard in international criminal tribunals, so one that excludes the official capacity defense. So it says for the purpose of the statute, the official position of any accused person at the time of the alleged commission, whether as head of state or government, shall not relieve such person from criminal responsibility. And then it also includes a provision which I referred to yesterday, excluding functional immunity. But it also includes a provision that in effect provides for immunity ratione personae. So under this provision, as you see, it's contemplated that the prosecutor of the special tribunal can in fact investigate and perhaps even prepare an indictment in relation to a serving member of the Troika, may even submit that indictment to the judges. But then it provides that where the indictment concerns a head of state, head of government, or minister of foreign affairs, the pretrial chamber shall not confirm the indictment and shall order the proceeding suspended. So that appears to be a recognition of immunity ratione personae in relation to the Troika. Now, the immunity of serving heads of state has also been particularly problematic or prominent with regard to the International Criminal Court. The ICC has issued arrest warrants to a number of serving heads of state, and in fact has had on trial a serving head of state. So the president of Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta, was in fact on trial while he was president, though the prosecution began before he became president and the case was dropped while he was president. As I mentioned on Monday, The court has outstanding warrants of arrest for at least four heads of state. I say at least because there might be other, which are sealed, but we know four. So the president of Russia, or heads of state or heads of government, president of Russia, prime minister of Israel, president of Myanmar, supreme leader of Afghanistan, the ones in office now. There are ICC arrest warrants in relation to them. Now, as I'm sure you know, those warrants are sent to the state's parties, to the Rome Statute. And ordinarily, those states have obligations to cooperate with the court, including ordinarily an obligation to arrest and surrender to the ICC persons wanted by it. Now, in the case of Russia, Israel, Myanmar, those states are not parties to the Rome Statute. And the ICC has jurisdiction over those leaders because the conduct was committed or is alleged to have been committed in the territory of a state that is a party to the Rome Statute. So in Ukraine, in Palestine, in Bangladesh. And then, of course, previously, the ICC had issued arrest warrants for the then states of Sudan and Libya. In those cases, jurisdiction was based on Security Council resolutions. Now, those cases are different from the case of Kenyatta in Kenya and the leader of Afghanistan, supreme leader, I think is the title by which he is known. Because, of course, those two states, Kenya and Afghanistan, at the relevant time, are parties to the Rome Statute, though the Taliban dispute whether or not the then government of Afghanistan competence to ratify. But can leave that aside and assume that Afghanistan and Kenya were parties to the Rome Statute. So there's a difference there between exercise of jurisdiction over leaders of states that are parties to the statute, exercise over non-parties. And the critical question, I think, in relation to the ICC is how should the nature of the ICC as a treaty-based institution, but an institution whose statute only binds parties to it, how should that be reconciled with the exercise of jurisdiction by the court in circumstances where the legal interests of a non-party are implicated? So, in my view, this is really the critical question. How does an international tribunal deal with the immunity of a, I'll just use head of state in, to summarize, immunity of a head of state that is not a party to the statute and not bound by the instrument that has created that court and which gives that court its powers and which also is the basis on which the state's parties to the court are acting? So that's the critical question in my view. So how does an international tribunal, and in particular the ICC, deal with leaders of non-parties? Now, this question of head of state immunity arises at two different but related levels. So firstly, there's the question of whether the immunity of the official provides a bar to the exercise of jurisdiction by the ICC itself, by the International Criminal Tribunal itself. And so, in that sense, at least the way it's been described in the literature, is that it deals with the vertical relationship between the state of the accused. And remember, the immunity belongs to the state, not to the individual. Immunity belongs to Russia, to Israel, to Myanmar, to Afghanistan. It's their immunity. So, the relationship between that state and the ICC. So that's the first question. Now, if the ICC does choose to initiate proceedings against a state official and then proceeds to request arrest and surrender, that then raises a second question, but it's a different question. The second question is whether the official is immune from arrest by the state party to the ICC. In other words, whether or not that official is, whether the immunity of that official subsists when a state is seeking to act at the request of the ICC. So this is what is sometimes described as the horizontal legal relationship. It's about the relationship between the state that is requested to arrest and the state of the official that will ordinarily be entitled to assert immunity. Now, the ICC statute provides for these two relationships in different provisions. So you've got Article 27 of the ICC statute and Article 1998. Article 27 2 deals with immunity of officials at that vertical level that I've been talking about between the court and the state. So 27 2 says immunities for special procedural rules which may attach to the official capacity, whether under national law or international law, shall not bar the court. It's explicitly addressed to the court, shall not bar the court from exercising its jurisdiction over such a person. Now, Article 27 2 reflects an agreement between the state's parties to the statute that their heads of state are not to benefit from immunity ratione personae before the ICC. Now, that provision, of course, you may contrast with the one that I showed you on the Special Tribunal for the Crime of Aggression, where they say if it's a head of state, you've got to stop. Also, in the Malabo Protocol, so the Malabo Protocol is the treaty that provides for the inclusion of criminal jurisdiction within the remit of the African Court of the proposed African Court of Justice, not yet in force. But actually, the Malabo Protocol has a provision that explicitly preserves immunity ratione personae. So 27.2 goes one way, the other two treaties go the other way in actually specifically providing for immunity ratione personae. Now, Article 98.1 deals with the second level of immunity, so the horizontal level. It's dealing with the relationship between states, though, as you see, that provision is addressed to the court. So, what 98.1 says is that the court may not proceed with a request for arrest or surrender where that would require the requested state to act inconsistently with its obligations, so the state's obligation under international law with respect to another state. So, 98.1 is intended to address that horizontal level. Now, in respect of states which are party to the Rome Statute, the issue of immunity is relatively straightforward, whether it's immunity before the ICC or as between states parties, though the second is not as clear, but I would argue straightforward because by accepting 27.2, they accept that the ICC can exercise jurisdiction, and you may say they've sort of waived the immunity of their state officials. And then one might argue that for the purposes of 98.1, where the state concerned or the states concerned are both parties to the Rome Statute, that they would not be acting inconsistently with their obligations. And on the whole, ICC states parties have accepted that, in fact, a number of them include this in their domestic legislation. They include specifically that with respect to state parties, they may actually proceed with arrest and surrender. And the ICC itself actually accepted this one checking that as between states parties, that is the conclusion. So the real question relates to officials of state that are not parties to the ICC statute. And in relation to the vertical relationship between the ICC and state officials, the question is whether or not officials of states that are not parties to the Rome Statute continue or whether they enjoy immunity from prosecution by the ICC. And if the answer to that question is no, in other words, if the view is taken that they don't enjoy immunity before the ICC, then two other questions that one has to answer. Question number one, how does one explain that? What's the legal basis for saying there's no immunity? And then number two, what effect does the absence of that immunity at the ICC have with regard to the horizontal level? Okay, so I'll start with the so-called vertical legal relationship. Now, the ICC has dealt with this question of whether or not heads of state have immunity before it in a number of cases, most notably in cases dealing with the Sudanese president Omar al-Bashir. This was actually a long-running saga. The court first issued its arrest warrant for Bashir, I think, in 2009. Bashir did, in fact, travel to a number of states that did not arrest him. And then the court, in a number of decisions, would sort of, if you like, chide those states' parties for failure to cooperate with the ICC. And in all of those decisions, the court was very consistent that Omar al-Bashir did not have immunity before the court. But the court was, at least for a period of time, actually, even till now, inconsistent with regard to its rationale for coming to that decision. And then, after the court issued the arrest warrant for President Putin, he went to Mongolia. Mongolia failed to arrest him. And a couple of years ago, there were also non-cooperation proceedings where the pretrial chamber again issued a decision. So you have a series of decisions of pretrial chambers in relation to Bashir, and that culminated in an appeals chamber decision, which one would have assumed would sort of settle the issue, and where the appeals chamber did try to settle the issue. And then we've had a pretrial chamber decision with regard to Putin and Mongolia. But overall, and I'll give you the range of theories that the court has used, not least because even though one would have thought that the appeals chamber decision would have settled it, actually in the Mongolia decision, interestingly enough, which came after the appeals chamber decision, they did not use the rationale of the appeals chamber decision, interestingly. So the court has relied on a number of bases, I would say four different arguments that the court has used, the ICC, for its conclusion that there was no immunity for the serving head of a state that was not a party or that is not a party to the Rome Statute. So the first theory relied upon by the pretrial chamber that issued the arrest warrant was based just on Article 27, the one that I showed you a moment ago. So the reasoning was fairly straightforward. We look at Article 27, it says immunity shall not bar the court. End of story. Was more or less the decision. It's an interpretation of the statute, and on that basis alone, the court was, the pretrial chamber was convinced that it was entitled to proceed. Interestingly enough, in the decision regarding Putin, just a couple of years ago, essentially the pretrial chamber went back to that theory. On the basis of Article 272, this is what binds us, and that was more or less it. Then the court has relied on a second theory, which was the one that the appeals chamber sought to establish in the Bashir decision. So it was a unanimous decision of the appeals chamber, I should say, with then four of the judges having a separate concurring opinion. I think all told, it's about 300 pages, and I don't know how many of you have waded through the, I think, more than 300 pages all told. And the essence of it, and we'll discuss this maybe in a bit more detail, the essence of it was that according to the ICC Appeals Chamber, under customary international law, there is no immunity for persons wanted for prosecution by international criminal tribunals. And on this view, the court wasn't relying on the ICC statute as such, but was saying independently of the ICC statute, this immunity does not exist before international courts and tribunals. And in fact, to go further, and we'll come back to this, in their view, the effect of this was also that a state that was acting at the request of an international tribunal is also not obliged to accord immunity. Come back to it. Now, the third and the fourth, and their variations of a theme, really, theories that the ICC pretrial chamber relied upon were based on Security Council resolution in the case of Bashir. Recall that in that case, the ICC had jurisdiction based on a referral by the UN Security Council. And the slight difference between the two is that in the third theory, the pretrial chamber justified the lack of immunity on the basis that the Security Council had waived the immunity when it imposed an obligation on Sudan to cooperate. So it's sometimes called sort of waiver theory. And then the fourth is one that says, well, the Security Council referral effectively places Sudan in the position of a state party. So by imposing obligations on Sudan, it's in the position of a state party. And because the state's parties have agreed that there's no immunity, in effect, the same applies to Sudan. So I should note that I've written on this and I have accepted this fourth theory in my own writings, but I won't dwell on that because actually the more recent cases have not come on the basis of Security Council referrals. And so we need to find some more rationale. And in any event, if either of these two are correct, then you don't need these at all. Though that is the case, actually, the ICC appeals chamber in Peshawar, though they said there was no immunity under customary international law before international tribunals, they adopted a sort of belt and braces, and they said in relation to Peshawar, in any event, they accepted this theory as well for there being a lack of immunity. But in the cases before the court now, Putin, Netanyahu, Myanmar, it will have to be either the first or the second or something else. Okay, so I'm going to focus on the second theory, the sort of the customary international law argument, no immunity before international tribunals. But before that, let me address the first one, actually, the one that says that bases it solely on Article 27. Now, one would have thought that that was sort of dead or regarded as irrelevant because the appeals chamber spent this kind of 300 pages relying on number two. And then only to get the next big case, the one relating to Putin, and you can just do a control F. The words customary international law do not appear in that decision relating to Putin. They just ignore it. It's almost as if what the appeals chamber had, as if that appeals chamber decision had never been given. I mean, not that they don't refer to it, but they don't actually refer to the basis on which the appeals chamber gave its decision. They went back to Article 27 and more or less the end of the story. Now, the difficulty, of course, with this, the difficulty with Article 27, two difficulties. First of all, though I'm dealing with the vertical level, it doesn't actually address the horizontal. But we'll come back to that. Secondly, and more importantly, is the fact that we're talking about the immunity of a state that is not a party to the statute. And again, that doesn't seem to be acknowledged. Now, the question is, to what extent can the statute remove the immunity that is accorded to a state that's not a party to the statute, given that the immunity is the right of a state? It's not the right of the individual, it's the right of the state. Now, the court, of course, is bound by its own statute. So you take that as the starting point. But nonetheless, the statute is a treaty. And so it's a matter of treaty interpretation and how the court interprets the treaty. And as the gentleman in front of me has written about extensively, you interpret a treaty in the light of other applicable rules of the international law. And so you need to engage with the relationship between the treaty and the general rules of immunity, and also the general rule that treaties do not bind states that are not parties. And the court didn't engage actually with any of that. So let's talk about the second theory, the argument that there's no immunity before international criminal tribunals. And that's the one that the Chair Appeals Chamber decision settled on. Now, in reaching that decision, the Appeals Chamber relied on two main points. And then there's a third point, which the Appeals Chamber itself didn't really talk much about, but which is sometimes advanced by other people about all three. So the first point that the appeals chamber relies on is, if you like, a point of principle. So the argument was that immunity is derived from sovereign equality and therefore only arises in states. And so on this view, immunity does not arise with respect to international courts and tribunals. So the argument was made that international courts and tribunals are fundamentally different, or the exercise of criminal jurisdiction by international courts and tribunals, fundamentally different from exercise of a criminal jurisdiction by states. And so the effect of this argument is to say you don't even need to find an exception to immunity ratione personae. It's actually the other way around. It just doesn't exist under customary international law with respect to prosecutions by international tribunals. So it's almost shifting the burden of proof. And in fact, that's really what the appeals chamber did. They said that the burden of proving that there's a rule that grants immunity in this case lies on the side of those who consider that it applies to international courts and tribunals. So you have to find that there's actually a rule that says it applies, and they say we can't find any such rule. So, I think the appeals chamber is not the only one to have, reasoned in this way. You shift the burden of proof and you say it's for you to prove it. Oh, sorry, you haven't proved it, and then we can proceed. So they said, and I'm quoting now, the onus is on those who claim that there's such an immunity in relation to international courts to establish sufficient state practice and opinio iuris. Now, to my mind, this alleged distinction between the position of international courts and immunity from the exercise of criminal jurisdiction by states doesn't withstand scrutiny. It suffers, in my mind, from one basic problem. International courts are created by states, as was the case by the ICC. And so, if states individually can't exercise criminal jurisdiction over foreign leaders, then it would seem to me to be problematic to say that they can then do so collectively. If they cannot do it individually, they can do it collectively. Sarah Nguyen, in an article she wrote commenting on the chamber's decision, the appeals chamber's decision, she said that that approach might be compared to saying something like, and now I'm quoting what she said. She said, it may be the case that people are prohibited from killing other people, but show me the evidence that this rule also applies when 122 people kill one person. She says it was a bit like that. Now, the danger, I think, with the ICC appeals chamber reasoning is actually made evident in how it defined the international tribunal. So it says an international tribunal is one created by two states. And of course, it had to accept that these tribunals don't appear out of nowhere. They're actually created by states. And as long as it's created by two states, the appeals chamber was of the view that actually immunity would not exist in that situation. But if this argument is correct, the argument that immunities do not apply before international tribunals because it's not the exercise of criminal jurisdiction by states, if that argument is correct, then the question would arise as to whether or not it's even confined to international crimes. If it's just something about the nature of the tribunal, that the tribunals are fundamentally different, then what if you have international criminal tribunals that are exercising jurisdiction over acts that do not amount to international crimes? Now, that could seem fanciful, but in fact, it's not, because we have had a number of, and I'll come to the question of how we define international tribunals. We've had a number of tribunals established, if you like, by treaty or under international rules that do, in fact, exercise criminal jurisdiction over crimes that are not crimes under international law. Certainly not crimes under customary international law, and in some cases, certainly crimes under domestic. So if you think, for example, about the Malabo Protocol, which I spoke about, the one that extends the jurisdiction of the African Board on Human People's Rights includes criminal jurisdiction, so it comes into force. It has a number of crimes within the jurisdiction of that court that are not international crimes. So unconstitutional change of government and a number of other crimes are included, which African states wanted this court to prosecute. Slightly different, but the special court for Sierra Leone also included prosecution of domestic crimes under the law of Sierra Leone. Even the ICC statute, even with regard to the ICC, it's not entirely clear that all the crimes are, I think they are, but it's not necessarily the case that all the crimes are crimes under customary international law. So, for example, the ICC statute allows the court to exercise jurisdiction over crimes created by men. And with respect to those crimes that fall within the jurisdiction of the court by an amendment, all it takes is the ratification of one state for the court to have that jurisdiction. So as long as the territorial state or the state of nationality ratifies that, the court has jurisdiction. And so it's not clear, well, according to the appeals chamber, even in those cases, even in those cases, because it's an international court, there would be no immunity. Now, I think recognizing, so that's the one problem with this argument, that it's on the basis of the tribunal itself, that there's a difference between international courts and domestic courts. One problem is actually it divorces it from the question of international crimes. Now, some scholars have recognized that problem, and some scholars have sought to remedy that problem by suggesting that, well, it's not about the nature of the international crime, sorry, the international tribunal alone, it's a combination. So that it's in cases where you have an international tribunal that is exercising what's sometimes described as the jus puniendi of the international community. So it's exercising the power of the international community to punish. So that would be a combination. It would be an international tribunal, but if it's the international community punishing, then it would also actually have to be an international crime. So on that basis, you would then be looking, you would, if you accepted that, you'd be solving two problems. You'd be solving the problem of how do we define an international tribunal. So the argument goes, because it wouldn't then just be what the states by treaty, that would not, in the view of these scholars, be one that has a, I think Klaus Kress calls it a credible universal orientation. So it would have to be something that is truly international. And then, of course, it would have to be with regard to international crimes. But I think even here, there are two problems with that, that argument. So the first one is a sort of doctrinal one of what is just the basis for establishing, you know, for this kind of argument. But even if we leave that aside, the second problem is the question of how do we know when we have this kind of international tribunal? How do we define it? How do we content? And this was what plagued actually the discussions around the Special Tribunal for the Crime of Aggression. Big obsession amongst some scholars and some states as well to try to find out how we would know whether it's a truly international tribunal or not. And actually for the ICC itself, even the ICC, questions would arise as to whether the ICC itself would be something that one might argue is sufficiently international, exercising the jurisdiction of the international community. I just did a calculation this morning. I thought, do the states parties to the ICC constitute two-thirds? I picked two-thirds, just arbitrary. It's actually just short of two. So it's not even two-thirds of the states that are members of the UN are parties to the ICC. And then, of course, if you think about it in other terms, we started with sovereign equality, but, you know, other terms, I then had a look, okay, countries with like top 10 populations in the world, the top five And the top five actually represent nearly half the population of the world. That shocked me, actually. The top five countries in the world by population is nearly 4 billion people, to my surprise. None of them is a party to the statute of the ICC. So, to what extent does even the ICC fulfill whatever definition we think, or it is said that one could give to this notion of an international tribunal? So, to my mind, this uncertainty regarding the scope, which really goes to the essence of it, so both doctrinal and in terms of how you make it work, seem to me to make it difficult to accept that there is a rule that suggests, or sorry, make it difficult to accept that under customary international law, this kind of immunity does not apply when states choose to create an international tribunal. Okay. Now, of course, the other way of looking at it is to say that this is the sort of second argument that can be made. So the first one is one that just distinguishes international criminal tribunals, if you like, by nature, and says they're different. So immunity, sovereign equality, and this is not, we're not in sovereign equality, we're in different terms. So the second point that was relied upon by the appeals chamber was actually practice. So this is sort of accepting that there might be a rule, but then saying actually there's an exception to that rule on the basis of state practice. So the appeals chamber referred to statutes of previous international criminal tribunal. I keep forgetting about the slides. They don't say very much. It's just a good clue. And I think that's the last one. So the second point is to say, look, you've got provisions in the statutes of previous international criminal tribunals, and they provide a justification for saying that there is no exception to this immunity. But the problem is that actually, if you look at the provisions that they referred to, they're essentially just the provisions like the one I showed you in the special tribunal statute. It's the ones that exclude the official capacity defense. That those are the provisions that the appeals chamber referred to, the ones that say the official position of an accused person does not relieve them of responsibility. So, a number of problems with this argument. Number one, those provisions actually don't deal with immunity in the sense that they don't deal with immunity ratione personae. I would actually accept that those provisions overlap with immunity ratione materiae, but they clearly don't deal with immunity ratione personae. And this is, to be fair to the appeals chamber, this is subsequent to the appeals chamber decision. But the statute of the Special Tribunal for the Crime of Aggression Against Ukraine actually shows exactly why those two things are different. So official capacity defense excluded, but immunity ratione personae is actually preserved. Same thing in the Malabo Protocol. So they just deal with different things. Secondly, in all the previous cases, the state concerned was bound by the relevant instrument. So the question that we're dealing with is not whether or not a given individual did not have immunity before those tribunals. The question is whether the head of a state that is not a party to the relevant instrument has immunity. And in all those previous cases, the states concerned were either party to or otherwise bound by the relevant instrument. And then thirdly, insofar as one is dealing with practice, there is actually practice that, at least recent practice for sure, where states have opposed the existence of a rule of customary international law that would suggest that there is no immunity. Now, a lot of that has developed in the context of the Bashir saga. But that practice nonetheless exists and was there, certainly by the time the appeals chamber made its decision. So, for example, the African Union had repeatedly declared that belief in customary immunity, ratione personae, in fact, adopting decisions in that regard. So, there is, in fact, some practice. What about today? So, post the decision in Bashir and in the light of more recent developments in the ICC. So in evaluating the position on system international law, of course, we'll need to think about the reaction of states to the arrest warrants against Putin and Netanyahu. And the question is, insofar as we're talking about customary international law, do these actually, does that development change things? The difficulty is, as you know, the reaction of states has been mixed. Some states have expressed willingness to abide by the decision of the ICC, in fact, to arrest those leaders if they were to come to their territory. And other states have expressed a different view, and some have just been ambiguous. So, though there has, in fact, been practice since then, it's very difficult to show that that practice moves the needle one way or another. So, in my view, those two arguments that the ICC Appeals Chamber relied on don't stand up to scrutiny, to the first two that I have on the slide. Now, the next question that, or the third point that is sometimes relied upon is that the ICJ, in the arrest warrant case, which I've spoken about, that the ICJ actually recognized that there is no immunity in relation to international tribunal. Because the court did talk about circumstances where a serving foreign minister or a foreign minister, should I say, could be prosecuted. They gave a number of scenarios. And the last one, the court said, was that there is no, that the foreign minister may be subject to criminal proceedings before certain international criminal international courts where they have jurisdiction. And the argument has been made that this establishes an exception to immunity, to at least recognize such an exception. In my view, though, the court was simply making reference to the fact that the statutes in some courts, like the ICC itself, and the court, in fact, did make reference to specific provisions of the statutes of courts. I think it was simply recognizing the fact that the statutes of some courts provide for a lack of immunity. It is the case that there is no immunity before certain criminal tribunals. But that doesn't answer the question of whether or not those statutes that the court referred to apply in respect of states that are not bound by that instrument. So it seems to me that the words of the ICJ are being used to carry more weight than they can bear. Okay, let me come back to the horizontal level problem. So, and this is the real problem that is facing states. So the real problem that's facing states is ICC issues an arrest warrant for President Putin, Prime Minister Netanyahu, whoever. And the question is, are these states entitled to, bound to arrest these individuals if these individuals come into their territory? That's the real question. And for some states, those that believe that there is no immunity with the officials of third states parties, the question is whether now there's a conflict of obligations. So they're clearly parties to the ICC statute, and whether that then requires them to violate their obligations in relation to these states. Here, though, this question of where do we start from? Do we start from absence of a rule and you have to prove the rule? Or do we start from we have a rule, we have to find an exception? Here at this horizontal level, it's actually relatively straightforward. We know that as between states, one state is bound not to exercise criminal jurisdiction over the head of state of another state. We know that that's the rule. And we know that that rule applies also to situations of arrest and detention. So in this scenario, it's quite clear that you would have to find an exception. You would have to find a way to assert that when the state is acting at the request of an international court, that there is, in fact, no immunity. And the ICC Appeals Chamber tries to engage with this a bit. They tried to engage with that question. And the argument that was made was that in situations where a state is requested to arrest by the FTC, that state is not actually exercising its own jurisdiction. It's acting, if you like, as some kind of surrogate or some kind of proxy also for the ICC, and that this does not engage the interstate immunity rule. But to my mind, this argument just doesn't hold up. So if we think about it formally speaking, it's just a question of attribution. When that police officer puts their hand on the person of the foreign head of state and says, "Sir, come with me to this detention center," the question that arises is the act of that police officer attributable to the state that has employed the person? Or when you have a court decision in those national systems that require a court to certify, is that act attributable to the state? Because if it is, then it clearly engages the interstate immunity rule. That rule will be engaged. Now, the argument that has been made that, well, it's the organization acting through the state. We've had a lot of cases and discussion about the extent to which the acts of state organs are attributable to international organizations. And for this purpose, the ICC is worth setting organization. And we know that the threshold for attribution of the conduct of state organs to international organizations, we know that that threshold is a high one. And we know also that even if a state is merely implementing a binding decision, even if a state is merely implementing a binding decision of an international organization, that does not mean that that conduct is not attributable to the state. We have lots of cases where precisely those questions have arisen, whether the state's human rights obligations are engaged in circumstances where it is acting at the request of an international organization. And even if the acts are attributable to the international organization, that does not exclude the fact that they are also attributable to the state. So it's not a binary. It's attributable to the organization, it's therefore not attributable to the state. The two things actually can be true and very often are true. Then you get to that argument, the one that says, well, it's kind of enforcing the jus puniendi of the international community. So the argument that this is the international court, one or international court it is, that's sort of acting on behalf of the international community, it seems to turn things the other way around. So I think it was Roger O'Keefe who said, in argument actually before the ICT, because they allowed amicus curiae to come in, and Roger in his humorous manner, he said, look, this mischaracterizes the relationship between the court and state parties. It's the states that have conferred jurisdiction on the court. It's not the court that confers jurisdiction on the state, which is in effect the argument that when the state is arresting, it is simply acting on behalf of the basis of the court. And what you then get to is something that says, if you take all of these arguments in substance, it would say states are not entitled to do this individually. But if they, in fact, get together and create an international tribunal, not only can the international tribunal exercise that jurisdiction, but then that international tribunal can actually give those states the power to do things domestically, which they would not be able to do. That's, in effect, where we get to with this argument. I think another problem, sort of doctrinally here, is if this argument is correct, that there is no immunity whenever you're acting at the request of the ICC or at the request of an international court because you are not, in fact, the one that is exercising that power. The question is then, what is Article 98(1) doing in the statute? Because Article 98(1) says the court may not proceed with a request or surrender, which would require the requested state to act inconsistent with its obligations under international law. That argument by the appeals chamber says actually, you're never acting inconsistent with your obligations when you're acting at the request of the court because it's not you. You are just, in fact, assisting. And so the effect of that argument is really to render Article 91 redundant. Now, some have said, well, it's not quite redundant because it might arise, for example, say in relation to like property of the third state, consular relation. You are now in the position where if it's a request to arrest the head of state, there's no immunity. But if you say we want a document, which might be, then you have to respect that immunity. That would be the position that one would come to. So I'll say that to my mind, none of these are really persuasive arguments with respect to immunity before international criminal tribunals. A final point, and this is a point that, again, I don't think the appeals chamber grappled with, but I mean, to be fair, maybe they didn't need to. Well, actually, they did because it did arise in one respect. There would actually still be the question of what happens with treaty-based immunities. So it's this point. How would you deal with treaty-based immunities, of which there are actually quite a number of them? So even with regard to Bashir, when Bashir went to South Africa, and likewise, actually, when he went to Jordan, he went for heads of state summit. So AU or Arab League. And in those cases, he was the representative of a state to an international organization. And actually, there were relevant treaties there. The same would be true if it was, say, a UN summit, the General Convention on Privileges and Immunities of the UN. The question would arise, how would this absence of unity under customary international law actually interact with state state immunity. So I'm abusing the fact that we still have a bit of time for Q&A just to make two more points. I mean, and so that would be a problem with this customary law that you would still have to think about the interaction of treaty-based immunities. But to sort of wrap up and to think about sort of where we are in relation to the situation. So even if I'm right, that the court is wrong and that there is, in fact, immunity with regard to officials of states that are not parties to the Rome Statute. Even if that is correct, the fact remains that the court has held otherwise. And the fact remains that the court has issued requests to parties to the statute, asking them to arrest and surrender. So the court has not, in fact, respected Article 98(1), which is directed at the court. It has, in fact, proceeded with that request. And the question is, what should the state's party do? So essentially, if I'm right, the state's parties are in a position where they owe an obligation to the non-state party, not I'm talking about the horizontal level now. They owe an obligation under customary law to the non-state party not to arrest and surrender. But according to the court, they owe an obligation under the Rome Statute to arrest and surrender. So they have these inconsistent obligations owed to different entities. Now, there's nothing in international law that actually, if the court is right and, with regard to what it says, once you move past the systemic integration arguments, there's no way of resolving that. So international law knows of situations where I can owe an obligation to Sandy, but I enter into a commitment which is inconsistent with the obligations that I owe to Campbell. That's possible. And the question is, how is this to be resolved? There's another issue which I think is at stake, which is not. I wondered whether I should call this a rule of law issue, but I'm not sure whether it's actually a rule of law issue. But there's a question around whether states should regard themselves as free to disobey decisions of courts because they are of the view that the decision of the court is wrong, whatever the reason why they think the decision of the court is wrong. And that's the difficulty here, that even if the decision of the court is wrong, in general terms, we don't want states to say, well, as long as you think that the decision of the courts is wrong, you go ahead and you do what you want to do anyway. And that's, in effect, the position that states are in. And so one can see the kind of trend towards complying with those court decisions, even though, formally speaking, there is no reason to prioritize the decision or the obligation that a court has jurisdiction over the obligation that the court that a court doesn't have jurisdiction over. Because that's the question. There is a court that will deal with the obligation under the ICC. And in many cases, there is no court that will deal with the obligation that you have with regard to the non-state party. And so the tendency, and I think for some good reasons, is that states will prioritize those decisions where there is a reason. But the problem with that is it doesn't actually solve the fundamental tension. And it will really, I think, only continue to exacerbate that fundamental tension that we. And I think only the court can really solve that problem. And then, of course, there's the issue of if you don't invite people to come, you never have that problem. Okay, why don't I stop here? I'm sorry I've gone a little bit over. Yeah. Thankfully, we have a bit more time.